I'm speaking with Paul Buell. Thank you for allowing the interview.
Happily.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm like many my age, and I suppose other ages. I'm somebody over 30, socialist since the early 1960s, who is stunned, very happy, and not knowing what's going to happen next in the most important events for at least the last decade, and some of the most remarkable that I know of. When I think of here I am in Wisconsin, and there are small towns that never have political demonstrations and vote Republican normally, and now have marches of 200 to 500 people led by young white people, with some minorities from the small towns included. It's a spectacular phenomenon, and it's going to take a while to understand it, but much more important than understanding it is watching it develop with its own sensibility.
Yeah, I think things are shifting. Let me get to first things first, because some of my listeners might not know you or know who you are. How would you like for me to introduce you in the podcast?
Oh, probably the least important is a retired senior lecturer at Brown University. Better would be a survivor of the New Left of the 1960s, and before that, the Civil Rights Movement, founder, editor of the New Left magazine for Students for a Democratic Society, titled Radical America. A decade later, founder, director, field worker, et cetera, of an NEH-sponsored project, The Oral History of the American Left, at New York University, an attempt to recover the deep thoughts of people who'd been active since the 1910s and were slipping away, even as I interviewed them mostly during the 1980s. Co-editor of the Encyclopedia of the American Left, editor of a dozen radical comics since 2005, historical nonfiction comics, and a scholar of the American left, of the Caribbean left, and of the labor movement in the U.S.
Can you recommend for the listeners one book that they should read?
Oh, gosh, that would be extremely difficult. Yes, I think I can. John Nichols, Nation Associate Editor, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. And it's basically about the Democratic Party since the days when Henry Wallace was the second most admired American, that is to say 1942, through the decline of the Democratic Party into a neoliberal operation. And John Nichols is not in the least without hope. He has a lot of hopes. The book was finished before Bernie was defeated, but he has a lot of hopes. But he has a very hard view of the decline in whatever would be called a progressive liberalism and what must be done to reverse that decline. So that would be my recommendation.
All right. Well, how did you come to political work?
I was growing up in a Rock Rib Republican county, Champaign County, Illinois, downstate, as we say, although not all the way down to the bottom next to the Kentucky border, but a conservative place, and yet a college town. And I strolled downtown on a summer day in 1961, and there was a picket line in front of a local department store over job discrimination. And spontaneously, without a hesitation, I joined it, and it was the best day of my life since I was 11 and pitched a no-hit game, and in Little League, of course. Those were two big days. And from there on, the civil rights movement died fairly fast in this conservative area, but there were opportunities to learn about the Beat Generation and other kinds of bohemian stuff there, and in a six-month stay in the slums of San Francisco. And Then came the New Left. The Students for a Democratic Society appeared on campus, and I was eagerly snapped up. I might say that in downstate Illinois, most of the activists were Jewish and from Chicago. And I was selected as a speaker because I was a Gentile from downstate Illinois and so looked more like the other students. Then there were years of SDS, the biggest movement I've ever been in, and then years of becoming a scholar, a labor historian, labor educator, and all that kind of stuff, mostly in the state of the little blue-collar state of Rhode Island, where the New Left hardly surfaced, but class sensibility remained very, very strong. And then I retired in 2009, and I'd already set myself on this task of creating nonfiction graphic novels because I looked upon that as the most important way to reach young people today. Only one more footnote. Early on through Radical America, I became a popularizer and devotee of the great Pan-African historian C.L.R. James, who had written Black Jacobins, the most important work on black struggles, along with W.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. These both portray a non-white population that was not merely victimized, but struggled its own way toward freedom, even when it was repressed later. So this was a crucial lesson within the New Left. And James was a scholar of sports, that is cricket, and of culture at large. And we New Leftists adopted him as our favorite saint because of his grand visionary qualities. So I wrote his authorized biography, and he's remained pretty central to the way I understand how the world operates.
I've been encouraging people that I interview to listen to my podcasts and contradict me and correct me.
Sure.
And voice alternative points of view.
Good.
So I've got an episode where I cover C.L.R. James, and one of the things that I really puzzled over was when he puts down the Moisés Rebellion. Listeners, I make a small guess here. I say that C.L.R. James put down the Moisés Rebellion, but it was Toussaint Louverture, of course, who put down the Moisés Rebellion. Because it seems like he's trying to hold on to the hegemony that he has over the existing power structures and protect the white settlers. But in doing that, he sort of sacrifices the initiative that the black revolutionaries had to fight against France. But maybe he didn't know that Napoleon intended to reinforce slavery. I just had so many questions around that. But
there's a very significant scholarship around that book and the field generally as it emerges one volume after another, mostly Duke University Press. And it's so complicated, the specifics there, and so much a matter of people who can read the sources and have made their own contributions to the history, that I would be at a loss to try to navigate that. But here's something that I learned really only after I wrote the authorized biography, and that is how much James writing Black Jacobins depended upon Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution.
Really?
Literarily, as well as strategically. He had it directly in his mind. It was a shock to me, but the people that really turned that up offered a big light bulb over my head. And if you think about that, if you spend a while thinking about that and put the two texts side by side, you may get somewhere, but one of the places that you probably get is a belief in the Bolshevik view of leadership.
Yeah.
And that itself might be the explanation, because when James gave up on immediate transformation led by the Western working class, he returned to his third world views, and you might say, and he looked to specific leaders around the global South and tried to understand how those leaders brought the vision of the entire population together. Now, he was continually disillusioned, as with Ghana, when he'd been personally close to Nkrumah at the late 30s in the U.S., and with Eric Williams of Trinidad. He had been Williams, he trained Williams since Williams was in knee pants, as they say, who turned against him in 1960, and other kinds of things. But James was looking for some idea or vision of leadership that would help to explain the understanding and mobility, motion of the global South. And all this may also go back to his interest in Trotsky and Trotskyism, or it may just be a way to look at things as people looked at Mao and Ho Chi Minh and other leaders.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that in its context, the American Revolution was progressive?
This is something upon which one can only be ambivalent. I tried in Radical America to stay away from that specific subject because others were, we were staying in the 19th and 20th centuries, but others were continually revising this. It certainly wasn't good for Native American populations, and it may very well have been not good for slave populations, which raises a giant question mark over the top of it. But then again, my distant ancestor fought in the American Revolution, so I pulled a little bit in that direction. And I think that the possibilities that were raised, both politically, militarily, and intellectually, were very real and certainly were looked to by anti-colonial revolutions from the 1920s to the 1970s, and done so very sincerely. So I think that our view is bound to be pretty complex, complicated, and contradictory.
That's really interesting. So I have so many questions about the history of socialism in America, but
okay.
I wanted to, because I cover somewhat the abolition movement,
mm-hmm.
and kind of gloss over the very important labor movements at the end of the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, what effect does all of that at the end of the 19th century, the whole the Knights of Labor, the Pullman strike, all of that, how does that still impact us today?
Well, that's, again, a very, very good question. And I would say off-center here that the grandson of the American Revolution fighter was a farmer abolitionist, my great-great-grandfather, who marched with Sherman through Georgia. So my sentiments are there, too. The thing about the Knights of Labor is that it doesn't grow out of the same roots as the European labor movement, which has been shaped by socialists. Socialists created the labor movement. Somewhat less true in the United Kingdom, but still somewhat true. In the U.S., it really isn't true. Socialists were constantly floundering in the 19th century. They were the immigrant left, and predominantly German until the immigration of the Jews in the 1890s, and frequently making the most catastrophic errors, like expelling the majority of sections of the American section of the First International, because those sections were women and were led by Victoria Woodhull, who was a spiritualist as well as a socialist. They regarded them as, you know, people we don't want in a workers' movement, and destroyed the First International section in the U.S. The Knights of Labor come from a different place. They were, in many places, like Rhode Island, overwhelmingly Irish. They were more female in women's heavy industry, such as textiles, than any labor movement had ever been in the U.S., and they were also inflected by various other forms of radicalism and even spiritual ideas, even a kind of Catholic solidarity that just could not find itself within the mainstream of American socialism. And indeed, Friedrich Zorge, the piano teacher who was Engels' insights into the U.S., often very bad insights into the U.S., much favored the AFL over the Knights. So the way I've tried to portray in the Eugene V. Debs comic the unique path that Debs takes towards socialism, which is really quite important, but among the books that were important to him was Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, this utopian romance of a future cooperative society that had enormous appeal. It was the second or third most best-selling book at the between the Civil War and 1900. So, again, utopianism is part of this other world of American radicalism that is distant from interracial populism, but on the other hand, maybe not so distant from interracial populism, which looked to a cooperative agricultural solution more than a historic class struggle with a happy ending. There's a famous reform convention in 1892 in Kansas City where union groups, women's rights groups, and political socialists all tried to get together, and populists all tried to get together under a common umbrella. And one big reason they couldn't do it is that the women reformers were temperance advocates, and they could not get along with German socialists, no way. But Francis Willard, the leader of the WCTU, herself was a Fabian socialist. So you can gather the complications.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what kind of question I want to ask about the progressive movement, but it seems very fraught to me that the movement for women's suffrage in particular had kind of a bad relationship with white supremacy, it seems.
In the South, most specifically, and in the North, an urgency to get the vote, which was soft on the race question without being terrible. Many of them were from abolitionist families. But they just put that single demand forward. While Frederick Douglass became a Republican Party regular and in some ways could be seen to have departed from radicalism of any kind. So there was an attempt immediately after the Civil War to bring together labor, the radical Republicans, and women's rights. And the movement seemed successful till the early 1870s. Then it fell apart, and each one of those movements went their own way. The labor movement remained part of a racist Democratic Party. The women's suffrage movement played whatever they had, the cards they had to play. And you can say the same thing for the black rights movement. They played whatever cards they had to play, but not necessarily together with other progressive forces.
So why was Eugene Debs so successful? Or maybe a way to pose the question is, why wasn't he more successful?
Oh, well, that's a nice big question. He was a guy who had been a rising figure in the Democratic Party in Indiana, known as a wonderful speaker and a rising figure within a craft union, which was on the rocks because the owners of the railroads were able to break up the craft unions or limit their influence. So when he calls for and leads the Pullman Rebellion of 1894, he calls for railroad employees of every kind to go on a sympathy strike. He called it the Christ-like act of the sympathy strike, because it would mean people sacrificing their lives, their livelihoods, in support of this one group of workers in Pullman, Illinois. At least west of the Mississippi, the strike is almost comprehensive. Tens of thousands of people, both striker, railroad people, and family members are out on the streets as part of the strike. And to me, now that I think of it, it does seem a little like Black Lives Matter. It was spectacular, and it was put down by federal troops. And it proved to Debs that working people would also need a political party of their own. So he comes with a tremendous backwind of support of ordinary people in middle America, something that never happened in the socialist movement previously. And he has a vast charisma, and it's also true that there were tremendous socialist organizers of various kinds, and that the socialist ticket was more successful in the state of Oklahoma than it was in New York State. So it was a deeply American movement, if you want to call it that, but with very heavy support of the new Eastern and Southern European immigrants who were building their movement, their headquarters, their newspapers in industrial towns across the East and the Midwest, and to a lesser extent out West. They were all very much in support of Debs. Well, why does it come to an end? The political party system is heavily weighted against any socialist party. And when the Socialist Party finished fourth behind the Progressive Party, led by Teddy Roosevelt, the venomous Teddy Roosevelt, in 1912, it became clear that although they could win hundreds of local offices, they were never going to be a serious threat to Democrats and Republicans. And then, as their demographic base shifts and more immigrant communities come to support Debs and the socialist movement, here comes the World War and the repression of the World War. So that had a crushing effect. But if you were to summarize all of this, you might as well say American capital was the strongest in the world. And the prospects of a socialist movement, or later a communist movement, being able to overcome the strongest force of capital in the world was improbable.
So it seems to me that there's been a kind of a split about the Russian Revolution in the United States. I talk about the history of the Russian Revolution in its context based on the New Scholarship, but I don't talk much about the reception of the Russian Revolution in the United States. What is your impression of that debate, of that split, if you want to call it, and where do you fall in there?
Well, it's a vastly complicated picture because in the Dakotas there was a lot of pro-Bolshevism, and in Minnesota there was a lot of pro-Bolshevism, and a number of others, Seattle, obviously, and other places that were not predominantly immigrant, but for the most part, and especially after 1922, when it was clear that great change was not going to come, the overwhelming support of the communist movement was by immigrants from Eastern, mainly, to a lesser extent Southern, to a yet lesser extent, but not insignificant Northern Europe, that is to say Finland, which contributed a lot more than its share to Bolshevism. Every problem we could describe in this comes out of a simple fact, and that is that until the First World War breaks out, there was confidence throughout the Western world that socialism was going to come and that it would restore order, bring a new order to society. This was an illusion in part because it was based upon the existence of empires as a source of prosperity. But it was also simply that the war and the division and working people killing each other in Europe had the most disheartening effect possible in the American left and elsewhere, so that Bolshevism was seized upon as the great consolation prize. And it, in some ways, it never rose above that level because people looked to Russia and then, of course, later China and Vietnam as being able to do things that we can't do as Americans, and so we should make every effort to support them because that's where the change is coming first. It's not coming here first. It doesn't wipe out all the great organizing in the U.S., but points to a simple fact that the idea that the strongest capitalist country was not going to be the center of the strongest left is an undeniable fact.
Does socialism have to be democratic?
You could say that as other parts of society, whether something is democratic or not is a good subject for discussion. I'm working intermittently with a new scholarship on the American labor's left, United Electrical Workers and the farm implement workers and other unions that were really left-wing. How democratic were the leaders of those organizations? And the answer is ordinary workers trusted their leaders, for workers also, led by Ben Gold. There was a sense that this great leader, through his personal sacrifice and having no family life and working 18 hours a day, is leading us into grand improvements in our lives and a vision of a socialist future. So he makes the decisions. That is perfectly normal, and that's the case in the mainstream of labor, to say the least, except the leaders are generally pretty corrupt, rather than being selfless and so on. That's the complexity of it. The Communist Party at no time was ever democratic. It was a competition among leaders, and when Trotskyists and Lovestoneites were purged, ordinary workers who I interviewed said, thank God that all the factionalism is over. I don't care who runs this organization as long as they support Russia. And that's a real practical working class attitude, which never went away. You could say that SDS was very democratic because all the decisions were made by the chapters locally, and it was destroyed when the national leadership seized the initiative and declared themselves to be super revolutionaries. That probably would be true, but you can go to the socialist movement, and the icons like Norman Thomas were terrifically important, and they, as much as they wanted to, ran the organizations or left it to regional people to run the organizations and functionaries. How involved are the 66,000 members of DSA in decision-making? Well, it's a very complex question because probably 60,000 of those members aren't particularly interested in taking part in decision-making.
Yeah. So I make a good deal of Peter Beinart's The Good Fight in my podcast. And reading along with it, it seems that there may have been a moment where the far left, in being anti-communist, split away from or decided to not emphasize organizing workers and instead focused on organizing students on campuses. Is that a fair description of events?
Well, Peter Beinart we're very glad that he came over to Jewish Currents because previously he was a hardline Cold War kind of guy who would never have thought of as being a socialist. I guess it's the change in Jewish Currents and the change in moods and his own middle-age intellectual growth and development. I know I'm stunned by it, and other people are too. It's a good thing, but it mystifies me, and I always look for little contradictions and his finger waving. Oh, you left wing people, if only you'd had people like myself around to tell you what you should do instead. the reality of the 1950s and 1960s is that the left as it existed, certainly the Communist Party, but the socialists and the movements around the Socialist Party and Michael Harrington and all that stuff, they were pretty much at a dead end. They couldn't figure out what to do, and their support within the labor movement was very often people who had purged the communists, like Walter Reuther, who is seen as a great hero by some people in the past of by some DSAers today. But, you know, Walter Reuther was already in the mid-1950s cracking down on black wildcat strikers in the UAW and soon to be bringing in retirees from the suburbs to vote against democratic challenges in the locals because he did not want to lose control over a situation that was becoming more and more bureaucratic from top to bottom. He wanted to benefit from it and send Martin Luther King $50. And that was substantially true of the formerly progressive Jewish organizations as well. They wanted to have it both ways, to exist within a socialistic movement that was moving slightly leftward or slightly rightward, depending on the moment, and at the same time take great credit for being such great people. But too many bad things had happened for that to be the case and for them to appeal to the new generation. Now, SDS from the middle 1960s, there was a group that wanted very much to get students to leave school or when they graduate to go into the factories. And that was the Independent Socialists, later International Socialists.
Are those and the people who put out the Militant magazine?
No, that's the other wing of Trotskyism.
Oh, okay.
And they hated each other and talked about hating each other quite a lot of the time. We'll have to have a footnote here. The Socialist Workers' Party supported Russia as a worker state, as it deformed a worker state.
Yeah.
The Workers' Party, which becomes IS, was third campish.
Okay.
And therefore, if you read New Politics, one that I began to write for it in 1970, they didn't even like the Viet Cong. You know, they were thinking there'd be some third revolution in Vietnam, and they push out the U.S. and Ho Chi Minh, which is just crazy. But regardless, they made that choice, those independent socialists, and they didn't factionalize within SDS, which we're very grateful for. There was a lot of attention to a worker-student alliance by the Worker-Student Alliance, which was a front for PL. And that didn't seem like a bad idea, except it was a ploy to set up a faction, which more than anything else was destructive in the trajectory of SDS, initiated vast factionalism, control over chapters, all the things that reminded very old people of the Communist Party in the 1920s.
Yeah.
But for the mainstream, you know, I'm talking of myself as somebody who'd become a Marxist in the early 1950s, certainly by the mid-1950s, and came into SDS as a Marxist. It was an ideal to reach the working class, but the reality was there we were on campus, and there was a vast anti-war, anti-racist student movement. We went with them, and it was Tom Hayden, and not who was a complete anti-Marxist. It was Tom Hayden, and not the socialist theorist who wrote the totemic book for the New Left.
I do a whole episode on the Spanish Civil War.
Indeed.
So what was the importance of the Spanish Civil War for American leftists or socialists?
Oh, it used to be said more in Europe than America that the greatest crusades are the lost crusades.
Yeah.
And this would apply. Many a Jewish parent in New York and even Madison, Wisconsin, ask why in the world their 18-year-old sons would want to go and fight in Spain so very far away when there were lots of other things to do at home usefully and World War coming and so forth. But as the last effort to halt the fascism in its tracks from taking over more and more of the world, it was a glorious crusade, and the mismanagement and bureaucratic crimes and so forth of the Comintern don't diminish from the heroism of the volunteers, Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I have a comic coming out about this, and whenever it gets finished, a couple of years from now. The controversy has managed to confuse a lot of people and push away from the heroism of everyone, regardless of what factional position they took into it. But coming back to C.L.R. James, who wrote a preface to Red Spanish Notebooks by a couple of surrealists, believe it or not, one of them Spanish, published in the late 30s, he and his friends, his followers, and all Trotskyists were convinced that if France hadn't declared a popular front, if the communists hadn't agreed to a popular front in the late 30s, there would have been a workers' revolution. And if there were a successful revolution in Spain, it would sweep back through France, and all of Europe would go socialist, thanks to workers' uprisings, if it were handled correctly by Trotsky's leadership. For a long time, I thought this was a realistic view of Trotskyism versus Stalinism. But in recent decades, I've concluded this is ridiculous, because there's no way that anybody in Spain could have defeated the Germans and Italians in their intervention. And if you were in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, you might have hated the Russians personally, but you were glad to get what minimal assistance that you could get in materials. And the same thing goes for the anti-colonial revolts of the 1950s and 1970s. If there were guns coming from anywhere, they'd be coming from Russia. So you can say that everything the Russians did was in their self-interest, which is true. That every opportunity to crush any dissent, they took it. That is true. But it's also true, as C.L.R. James wrote about Paul Robeson, who had been his dear friend in the 1930s in London, that Robeson had decided just to put the questions of Russian life on hold and to pretend he didn't see them, because all those anti-colonial revolts, which seemed to many Marxists, especially ex-communists, to be shaping the world of the future, were only getting aid from Russia. I would always say that every left group wished to interpret the Spanish experience in their own way. I heard a 90-year-old survivor of the labor group speak in Minneapolis 30 years ago, and he was very wonderful and not terribly convincing. He was wonderful for his heroism, as being Spanish himself. But the idea that a different decision could have been made, or if, you know, something is always contrary to history to come up with some very different solution.
So you don't have to answer this question, but did you vote for Hubert Humphrey in 68?
Absolutely not, and I don't regret that. I'm not Todd Gitlin, who's gone through 50 years of regrets, collective regrets, usually for the rest of us, because for our generation, the war was the crucial thing, and although I certainly did not become a weather person and thought the idea of a revolution in the immediate future was just nuts and destructive to political activity. At the same time, the connection of the Vietnam War with the struggle against racism in the U.S. was central. And when King came out against the war, he put a target on his back. Everybody knows that. But when Michael Harrington and Irving Howe and these other people, until 1970 at least, had the view that the U.S. must stay in Vietnam, even if they should shoot less. We used to call it the shoot a little bit less view of Vietnam. We were compelled morally and politically to urge victory for the Vietnamese, which put us into a corner politically, but it's a corner that we had to take on. The Yiddish communists used to talk about the Schwere Linie, the tough line. And one of them, age 85, said he remembered twice in his factory. Once was supporting the Hitler-Stalin Pact, but the second time was supporting affirmative action. And you know that the Alva Shanker was the foremost opponent of affirmative action, along with George Meany. And Bayard Rustin wasn't in support of affirmative action either, because he'd shifted over to the right. So it was a time of taking very tough stands. Now, if you ask me if Robert Kennedy had lived, would I have supported Robert Kennedy? The answer is probably yes. And for that matter, Eugene McCarthy too.
So Bobby Kennedy probably wanted to end the Vietnam War, but he was not...
He had an unsavory past.
he was not dogmatically against American intervention
elsewhere in the world. But he seemed to, as you watched the crusade for his nomination grow in the spring of 1968, winter and spring of 1968, he seemed to be uniting vast forces of change behind and alongside himself, from Cesar Chavez to, you know, practically anybody that comes to mind and wasn't crazy. So he seemed capable of, you know, you can think of him as an insider as opposed to Bernie Sanders, who in spite of being a Democratic senator is still an outsider. But there's a similar thing in that Bobby Kennedy was legitimating a grand vision and movement for massive social changes. And Hubert Humphrey represented the munitions industry of Minnesota. You know, he had personally expelled all the communists from the Farmer Labor Party in 1949 in Minnesota, and he couldn't be moved away from his hardline anti-communism because he always wanted to prove, as opposed to Republicans, that he could be as hardline as them.
So, were you involved with DSOC?
I held back. I think it's because I was in Providence from 1973. I held back from joining NAM, which would have been the movement of people who'd been in SDS. DSOC was highly Eastern and really a bit more compromised with the views of dissent, old liberal anti-communism that I would have been comfortable with. Eventually, I became somewhat more comfortable. Especially when my pal at the 1968 SDS convention, Michael Kazin, became the editor, then I became yet more comfortable, but never entirely comfortable. So that when they merged in 1981 and Dorothy Healy became a member, I thought, okay, this is okay. I was would never have been interested in joining the Communist Party, but Dorothy Healy seemed to represent an eclectic left, a comprehensive left that wasn't DSOC.
I mean, I think it's interesting as you describe this, you're not talking so much about the ideas that drove people, you're talking about people that you identified with or that you trusted.
That certainly would be a part of it, but, you know, already after 1981, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon was for many people, including me, the Gentile in New Jewish Agenda, absolutely central. And one of the leaders of DSOC, so-called leaders of DSOC, Michael Walzer, was an avid supporter of the invasion. And in general, in that section of DSOC, they couldn't be against the invasion. And they couldn't support the ANC, because it was linked to the South African Communist Party, and so forth and so forth. So you could say that it's based on individuals instead of politics, but there's a politics within the individuals, and when people argue in DSA, some of this stuff among the old-timers still emerges because there's a horror of supporting the Palestinians in any way, shape, or form by one a group of aging socialists and or social democrats, self-described, and these things are still sort of there. They never went away.
So, what was the strategy of the DSA for approaching power? I'm thinking before 2016, through the through the 80s and through the 90s. What was the idea?
You know, I would say one of the – well, there's three or four things, and I mentioned some of them in the Debs comic. One was certainly the new politics movement of the 1970s, where campus activists and others took over well over a dozen cities, including Madison, and proclaimed a kind of peace and environmental visionary politics, and then was slammed down by the center of the Democratic Party, and Carter winning the nomination was part of it. He was a great ex-president who was a pretty bad president because he represented the return of the hawks to the central power in the Democratic Party. The midterm Democratic conference of 1978 was the high point of DSA, or rather of DSOC, and socialist influence. They actually seemed to have an influence. And then comes Reaganism, and the two moments of DSA influence were the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 1984 and 1988. But of course, some of the Social Democrats never liked Jesse Jackson, to put it mildly. He wasn't trustworthy on Israel. That's the only subject that, or that's the subject that pushes other subjects aside. And Harrington himself wavered frequently. He wanted to always be in touch with Albert Shanker, and even more astonishingly, Daniel Moynihan, his friend from youth, who'd become Reagan's emissary. So there was this. There's another element which is important, and that is every social movement, every anti-communist socialist movement in New York since 1900, is dependent upon financial assistance from the bureaucracy of the sector of the labor movement. That is to say, the so-called Jewish unions, the ILGWU, and then after 1965. Or earlier, the AFT. So that in order to keep the national office going, Michael Harrington had to sort of maneuver, weave around, and accept both financial help and a kind of New York City influence of AFT leaders, even when rank-and-file AFT chapters were bitterly opposed to the leadership. And Michael Harrington did it. He managed to keep enough money coming in, and he went so far as to support Michael Manley and write resolutions for the Socialist International, whatever the effect of those resolutions were, and sort of keep everything on an even keel by never letting the different and conflicting sides go at a murderous war against each other. And again, never reaching more than 5,000 members.
Well, what I remember from the 90s, the few anarchist people that I knew who were trying to attract me to left politics would have been completely revulsed by any kind of electoral activity whatsoever, much less the unspeakable sin of endorsing a Democratic candidate, no matter their politics, including Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
I got you. Well, there's another world which was epitomized by the success of the reformers in the AFL in 1995, throwing out the CIA crowd, or at least the leading CIA crowd around Lane Kirkland. And that led to a movement that lasted about 2 years but seemed phenomenally helpful. What was it called? I'm not even coming up with the initials now, but it was SAWSJ, which we called sausage.
Huh? Sorry.
Sausage and scholars, activists, and writers for social justice.
Uh-huh.
And it was sponsored by the AFL. We held an event, big event in Washington, financed, I think, by the AFL. It had thousands of academic contacts, make that hundreds. And we had local chapters and big, big campus events, students who were then activists in getting products advertising the campus, not made in sweatshops around the world, the anti-sweat movement. And we would have progressive labor movements, labor leaders come, and Democratic hacks and others that seemed to be for a new joint movement of labor and workers, and labor and students. And then it disappeared a couple of years later, partly because the AFL suddenly lost interest, saw it as too radical, or just didn't. The reform leadership never really took hold to make any changes in the AFL. That's basically what happened. But you could say, who were the groups that were closest to this would-be movement on campus, and they would be the young communists and the young socialists. And those are the two groups that supported Democratic candidates. And the biggest student mobilization to Brown was always people going to New Hampshire or someplace for a Democratic peace candidate for president. And the communists never talked about being communists, and the socialists never talked about being socialists. But they all were eager to support a Democratic Party peace candidates. Then it disappeared.
Huh. That's too bad.
Yeah.
So
those moments. Yeah.
So you were a founding member of the North Star Caucus.
No.
No?
Most definitely not. No, by the time I come into it, which is at least 1 year and maybe 2 years, it was firmly founded, and I sort of thought it represented the remnant of the old social democratic perspective that normally would find me unpleasant or would not like to be in contact, or viewed me as something distant, and was more New Yorkish and more Jewish than any other section of DSA, which is neither of which is a bad thing, but just a statement of reality. And now I think it's become much broader. But, you know, if there's a DSA discussion list in North Star and there are 20 people who add their opinions, who the hell are these 20 people, including me? And if there's another list that's about people involved with labor or interested who have been involved with labor, that's another 20 people. Who the hell are they? You could say that the labor list is full of aging people who came out of the Trotskyist movement and were part of Labor Notes and are playing a very, very avuncular, excellent role within DSA and for young people. And who are the New Yorkers and others in North Star? I'm puzzled by it, but a lot of people seem really excellent, and only a few people seem terribly crabby or sectarian and nutty. So I don't have any broader or more comprehensive view of what it is and what role it plays.
Yeah, I'm...
Plus, I'm 75, and I don't think I should be making definitive judgments for a movement of 25-year-olds.
Well, I think that people typically come off as more rude online than they
would
right. In person.
That's right. Entirely correct. Entirely correct.
I'm trying to find the DSA North Star regarding Joe Biden, because I wanted to ask you what you thought about it. Because sometimes these statements, you're in a group and the group produces a statement and you might find out about it afterwards.
That's correct.
And you might say, well, I don't necessarily agree with everything in this statement, but
yeah,
the rest of the group wants it and I don't see anything too terrible in it. So
you,
go ahead.
You've captured the experience.
So I wanted to give you a chance to, you know, voice your opposing view.
My view shared by, I would say, the non-sectarian Bernie people at large, which is that we lost our champion and we'll never get over it. And that's something that we have to live with. And although we weren't drastically cheated as in 2016, it's still a tragedy for American idealists. But we could easily say that we will vote for Joe Biden along with supporting progressive candidates endorsed by DSA and not endorsed by DSA at every level. And also say that the great problem that faces is that Joe Biden is a terrible candidate. There's nothing in his history which says he won't regress to his lifelong pursuit of the white middle-aged man that's been his political aspiration since the 1980s, and fall back into some kind of, I can be tougher on China than Trump is. I can be tougher on Russia than Trump is. Or Trump wants to pull out of Afghanistan, but I don't think we can. We wouldn't be able to defend our gains, which would be typical Democratic Party centrism that turns people off, especially with Hillary Clinton, who was a total hawk. But it's always hovering in the background. And when Biden condemned the Organization of American States for including the Venezuelan government, you know, it was altogether too typical of the Cold War Democratic Party and its connection with the military-industrial complex. That's the whole story, dragging down progressive candidates and always wanting to get rid of the Jesse Jacksons as being troublesome and annoying and divisive, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, my view is that Trump may very well defeat himself. It's also possible that Biden's choices of vice president might be decisive. But nobody would be surprised if a month ago, if Biden had chosen Amy Klobuchar as somebody who he could govern with, quote unquote, who was nothing but a neoliberal. Now, things may be different. But I still think that in spite of empty phrases, Joe Biden really doesn't like this mass movement on the streets. It makes him nervous because it's way beyond his horizon of what should happen in the American political process. And that as we get closer to election, stability, his version of a softened law and order, return to normal with U.S. foreign policy, which was a bad normal, all those things are going to be in front of us and are going to deter young idealists.
So let me ask you this. Let's think about, what if there's a second Trump term? What's the way forward for the movement in that case?
I guess I'm not thinking about that too much, out of fear and horror. But unite the progressives and divide the reactionaries. The irony of the Trump election, one of a thousand ironies in 2016, is he proposed himself as a peace candidate and said he would end the forever wars. And a lot of veterans like that. So we would have a need to press forward on the U.S. Hardline foreign policy and press against those who are running it, and for the alternatives offered by hardline Democrats as not being truly an answer, but to build independent movements. Maybe the movements on the streets in the last 2 weeks is the best guide of ruling out anything else I just said, which is to say that the important thing is the movement and the less important thing are the elected politicians, because by and large, the cynics are right, the young people are right, we're not getting very much from elected politicians. Do I want to see Trump thrown out of office so that all the environmental laws can be returned and something about carbon neutral by 2050, which itself is a ridiculous idea that Biden is not in any way committed to, et cetera, et cetera. But if Trump is reelected, then the mass movement is in the streets. With what consequences, I can't say. But it's in the streets right now.
I was listening to Ezra Klein interviewing Ta-Nehisi Coates the other day, and Coates expressed a great optimism, and the way that he framed it was that compared to our situation in 1968, right now is much better because, according to Coates, white people see what's happening. And in 1968, all of these things were happening just as they are now, except that the white community was by and large ignorant and maybe willfully ignorant of the fact. Are you hopeful?
You know, time is running out of global warming. So if I were 21 and I were thinking it when I was 40, that most of the species in the southern half of the planet would be extinguished. It would be difficult to be hopeful in that sense. But in the sense that youth is on the move, sure, I'm hopeful for that. The striking thing about events at the present that remind us of 1968 is that there were many sympathetic people of all ages in 1968, and some of them were pretty well organized, and it can't be forgotten that the tens of thousands of people who left the Communist Party or communist milieu, I mean tens of thousands, who are active organizers, were not in any left group, but were still active in peace and social justice and anti-racist stuff. So they were around, but it's not untrue that by and large older Americans couldn't really get a handle on what was happening because they were so struck not only by race but by drugs and sex and all these things that seem to be part of the young generation. And now the question is, youth is in the leadership again on the streets, and 90% of the people we see in those photos are under 30. Are older white people really sympathetic towards that? I'd like to think so. Maybe so.
All right. Paul Buell, you've been great. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thanks so much.
An almanac tells us what the climate is, when to plant, and when to reap. In this Democratic Socialist Almanac, I'm going to review the history of the socialist tradition in the light of the latest scholarship. I'll be talking about the good, the bad, and every one of us living in between. Once we've sorted out how we got here, we'll survey the paths now open to us and begin a discussion of where we want to go. Follow us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. We're only ever as free as our neighbor is, and we're only as strong as we are clear on where we're headed.